If you guys didn't get Shay's note in Facebook, we had to change the time of our event. If you guys didn't change that, I told you guys yesterday 6 for our celebration dinner. It's 7. That was the only time they could accommodate us. So we're at Sal's on 1st and Alluvial, Fresno and Alluvial. Those streets are the same to me. I lived here 12 years and cannot figure out which one's which. It's on Alluvial. Fresno. Thank you. See, some of you non-Texans need to tell me this. So yeah, 7 to 9. Bring a date or don't bring a date. All paid for. So anyway, just want to make sure we're all square on that. So cool. All right. Let me pray, and then we will dive in once again. Father, thanks for yet another morning. Just pray that you would give us endurance to finish. I know many of us are tired and lots going on with jobs and life and school and exams come in. And Lord, we're weary in some regards and yet excited to be here. So Lord, keep us fresh, if you will. Keep our minds astute and our hearts tender to your leading in our lives. Father, pray that we would just continue to learn this morning as we look at some tough texts. And yet, Lord, pray that you would you would use them for our redemptive purposes in the midst of this, God. So thank you. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. All right. Well, we saw the fall of Camelot, I guess, if you will, yesterday. We were seeing now David's turn for the worse. We saw the pinnacle of his kingdom through the eyes of Samuel as he wrote this, or whoever wrote this. Samuel said at this point. But you're looking at obviously this great man, this great kingdom that David has been charged to steward, if you will. We saw his heart with Mephibosheth. We see his heart for his enemies, even to be kind and generous to those that are outside of his friendship circle, if you will, but yet is kind to those anyway. We see God giving him peace on all sides. We see the Davidic covenant in chapter 7. And then in chapter 11, we see it all come to kind of an e-break, if you will, kind of a grinding halt. And we walk through kind of this initial sin with he and Bathsheba. And I want to pause a moment and ask a couple questions before we kind of move on. But we're about to see kind of the rest of the story. And oddly enough, the most righteous guy in the whole story in this piece is not David, it's Uriah. He is the guy that is a man full of integrity. He is a guy that's going to be loyal to his wife, loyal to David, loyal to God first and foremost, and he's going to be the guy that comes out of this story with, kind of his halo on straight, where the rest of them are a bit crooked. So I made a statement yesterday, and I'm just interested, specifically maybe from the gals. I see, at least in this piece, the potential that Bathsheba certainly is culpable for her actions in here, and maybe not just culpable, but maybe even desiring of David. Ladies, what do you see? Is that fair? Do you see a different angle to this? Guys, you can chime in after that, but I would be interested to see, knowing how the story unfolds. They're going to have a kid together. They're going to get married. David is the king. He's in a place of power. Give me your feedback. What do you see? Yeah, that wasn't uncommon, so that wouldn't have been an odd deal at all. So now,
so far we know she showered on the roof, and the king called for her.
Yeah, and she came.
But like in that time when a king asked to see you,
I would go. Whether I was knowing that was going to happen or not. So yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, Haley.
Mm-hmm. But she could just as easily be like, oh, I want to sleep with the king.
Mm-hmm.
You could easily have either side of it.
Yeah. And I hate making an argument from silence, but when you see the punishment doled out later, who gets punished?
She does.
David does. She doesn't. She's not named or is not, the text doesn't speak to that. Now, David's going to get, man, he's going to get hammered by God because of this. Immediate forgiveness, right? But there are significant consequences, and it's put on David. So I don't know. What else? Yeah, Anna.
I don't know about that. I think she got punished too, because she lost the
Yeah, and I certainly don't make light of that.
I think
for sure.
I was told
Totally. Yeah. Well, yeah, and it's one of the stories we wish maybe there's a little bit more from her perspective. Fellas, any thoughts?
No.
Steven is smart to keep his mouth shut. Well, wrestle with it. Yeah, Andres.
She does is going to force that man to like rape her or to sin against her, sin against God. I think ultimately that's going to be his choice.
Mm-hmm.
And to say that, like, well, she can't bathe on her roof, the roof of her house, I don't know, I think it just gets a little sketchy.
Yeah, you're opening up a fascinating can of worms. And I think it's a fair one to open up, to be honest with you. I was reading the other day, I forget where it was, probably Facebook, but let's be honest, probably Facebook. And it wasn't the Bathsheba story, but it was speaking of how women can dress. I think it was probably one of those yoga pants, like, right, dialogues, and they get really heated, right? And I was reading through the comments of how women were reacting to that. And on one side of the equation was the very conservative viewpoint of how dare you, you know, you're causing men to sin by what you wear and being aware of that. And the other side of the argument was this really, just this, look, it's my body. I can wear whatever I want. It does not matter. If you, male, have a problem with lust, that's on you. So shut up and deal with it, kind of type attitude. Now, they all weren't like that, but if you peg the two sides in an extreme, that's kind of where they camped, right? And I think it is an interesting argument to look at. You know, does a woman have the right to wear whatever she wants? Well, I guess she does. Is it wise? Maybe not. Is it considerate of other believers to think through that lens, right? Is it okay for me to have one of you over to my house that I know struggles with, has alcoholism in their past or whatever, and have wine? Well, I have that freedom. So what's wrong with you? Like, why can't I enjoy? Why can't I enjoy my freedoms? And you just deal with your own issues. Those are your issues. Those aren't on me. And I just was fascinated reading through that line of thinking of how, in my opinion, how incredibly selfish and self-centered that viewpoint is to not consider first the needs of others. Man, I'd love to have. I don't like wine, but my. You know, to at our house, like, that's not uncommon for us to, you know, hang out with friends and enjoy a margarita or something. But boy, to do that knowing that someone else would potentially be caused to stumble as a result of that, I see that as a very immature view of the Christian life in Romans 8 and Romans 14. So wherever you guys land on it, I think all of those opinions need to be looked through the lens of, man, how does this affect other people around me? And if I'm acting like Christ, their needs and their situation should supersede my own freedoms. So is David completely culpable for his actions? Absolutely. Is there anything that Bathsheba should be blamed for because David? No, not at all. But did she help the situation? Was she wanting that? Was she... No, I think you said bait yesterday. I thought that was an interesting word. I think she was. So it's interesting that it seems like this, there's a movement towards this idea of I have rights and I need to defend those, and maybe, I don't know, maybe this is just the yoga pants feed that keeps hitting my Facebook scroll, but whatever. Yeah.
I think it's interesting because we just had, like, David, and, like, when he was parading around, and, so it was, he was in his robes, right, his priestly robes.
Yep.
But then
his ephod. He's in a gigantic, long, white bathrobe. There's nothing inappropriate about it. It's very undignified. It's very unkingly. But there's not a woman that's going, wow, that's really causing me to stumble because I can see David's quads or his pecs, right? That's not at all. He's not dancing around in his bikini briefs, okay? That's not the picture. So, I don't know. And for the most part, and not to put people in camps because that's not fair either, women are not as visually driven as men. Now, that's shifting a little bit, and it's maybe not as extreme as we would have camped that, placed the arguments in those camps years ago, but for what it's worth. So that's, yeah, this isn't underwear as we think underwear today. It's a big, long bathroom.
The only thing I look at, and going back to a sermon I heard on this years ago, is kind of the blame on both of them of what type of premeditation there might have been, because if Uriah, you know, Uriah was one of David's mighty men, that's not like they didn't hang out. It's not like they were not friends or close. So there's no way that if looking at the greater context of, like, probably doing life, I mean, we're only getting snapshots of, you know, David's life as he's going through here. The reality of it is most likely Uriah and the other mighty men ate at David's table on a regular basis and brought their people with them. And you go from, like, verse 1, 2, and 3, you know, David sent everyone out.
Mm-hmm.
David's supposed to go out with mm-hmm. his armies at that time,
mm-hmm.
and that right there was probably the quote, like the first sin that would have been going on is David didn't go, is not where he's supposed to be and leading his army.
Agreed.
And then, I mean, the truth is, you know, if she's bathing regularly, it's on the roof, so he's most likely knows this. And the pastor that I talked about this up in Salem just kind of looked at it as a kind of going, how much of this was possibly premeditated between both of them, in the sense that, you know, hey, there's a great way to get
yeah.
a husband out of there, because one, why settle for a lieutenant when you can get a general?
Yeah. Maybe. Certainly. And again, it's one of those hard things because we're arguing from silence and assuming a lot of things in the culture, but I don't know that that's far off. I'm sure they ate together. I'm sure they hung out together at some point. Like, their lives crossed paths without a doubt. So, can I make maybe just a general statement in regards to that? Maturity, Christian maturity, considers others, period. And if your decision-making process, whether it's what you put on, what you say, how you speak, how you drive, whatever, is inconsiderate or does not consider or does not factor in other people, that is, by definition, immaturity. Okay? So just to throw that out there. Everything we do, we're third. God's needs are first. Others' needs come before our own, and then we're third. And if your rights are infringing upon other people's freedoms or other people's walk with God, it is your job as a believer, it is my job as a believer, to set aside my rights that I don't have anyway to consider other people first. Now, there are exceptions to that rule, but for the most part, if you factor in your life and you don't put somewhere on that radar, how is this going to affect the people around me that are believers, that are outside the camp, whatever it may be, that is immaturity. So that may be a little bit too persister. I'll chew on that for a little bit, but by definition, I think that's probably a fair example. Okay, so for all of us, not just, I hammer on women in the yoga pants issue just because I happen to read that, but there are other issues that we do as guys as well that are completely inconsiderate of other people around me, and I am guilty of them as well. So, okay, so just noodle on that, all right? Now, with that, let's get back to David, shall we? We need to see the rest of the story play out. So we've got, obviously, a sin issue that's come to the forefront. David has been, is completely guilty here. We're going to see that through the eyes of Nathan the prophet. We're going to see that through the eyes of God. He has had, circumstantially, the worst possible thing, if you're trying to hide your own sin, happen, and that the woman that he has now slept with and ushered off is now pregnant, okay? 11 verse 6 now, we're going to see this story kind of unfold and what's going to occur. Okay, David sent Joab saying, send me Uriah the Hittite. David's going to bring Uriah home, Bathsheba's husband, with hopes that, Lord, you know, maybe he'll sleep with his wife. Like, that's the best thing that he can hope for at this point. And as it seems to be consistent with Uriah's character from everything we see of this guy, he is amazing. He really is kind of the hero of the story, if you will. Uriah came to him in verse 7. David said to Uriah in verse 8, go down to your house, wash your feet. And Uriah went to the king's house, and a present from the king was sent out after him. But in verse 9, Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. And he gives the explanation here. Uriah told David in verse 10, Uriah did not go down to his house. And David says, why not? And Uriah says in verse 11, the ark in Israel and Judah are staying in temporary shelters, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the field. So I then shall go to my house to eat and drink and lie and be with my wife. By your life and by the life of your soul, I will not do this thing. My boys are sleeping in a field with the ark in battle. I am not going to go down to my house and enjoy the intimacy of my bride. Like, that's wrong in his eyes. Now, did he have freedom to do that? Absolutely. Did he have a conviction to say, man, what's happening here supersedes that and I won't do it? Absolutely. Okay, so David's plan is backfiring quickly. So David now is going to ramp up the snowballing effect of trying to cover his sin. And he says, hey, stay here today. Tomorrow I'll let you go. Verse 13, David called him. He ate and drank before him and made him drunk. So he comes in now, eats at the king's table. He gets Uriah a little tipsy and says, now surely, with a little bit of wine in him, he'll go down and be with his wife. And the second time, verse 13, he did not go down to his house. Now David's stuck, right? There's no way to cover this up. Uriah is a man of integrity, of high moral standards. He will not go down and sleep with his bride. And now David is going to have to find now another way to fix this problem. And you just wonder, again, if David saw this coming, if David saw the progression of sin in his life, before he committed these actions, if he wouldn't have pulled the e-brake, okay? Somebody pick up in verse 14 now. Let's watch what David's new plan is.
In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter he wrote, set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him, that he may be struck down and die.
So advance the troops, put Uriah in the front. As soon as you guys get to a battle situation, everybody pull back and leave Uriah sitting out there by himself. And by the way, who delivers that letter? Uriah. His death sentence is in his hand, and he doesn't even know it. Like, man, just the integrity not to read that letter, right? So, I mean, what a horrible situation. And that, and the rest of the story in chapter 11, is exactly what happens. He sends him out. Uriah dies. Joab sends a report back by the way of a messenger to David saying, hey, this has happened. Joab is a little suspicious of what's going on, right? He understands this is not good battle strategy. David's a warrior. He knows how to fight battles. This is not what you do to win battles. So Joab is instantly tipped off saying, something's wrong. Something is off here, but doesn't know exactly what's happening. But lo and behold, Uriah dies in the battle. Report gets back to David that indeed Uriah is dead. David says now to the messenger in verse 25, thus you shall say to Joab, let this thing not displease you. For the sword devours one as it devours another. Make the battle against the city stronger and overthrow it, and so encourage him. Hey, tell Joab, man, war's war. Stuff happens. That's a bummer. We're sorry. Boy, we're grieved over that. But continue the battle. Defeat the city. Onward and upward. Uriah, verse 26 now. The wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead. She mourned for her husband, which would have been 7 days to 3 weeks, somewhere in that time period. Verse 27, when the time of mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife, and she bore him a son. Now, again, I can make the argument both ways. She's offered, hey, do you want to be David's wife? And she says, yeah. So she comes into the household. Is she desiring of that? Is that what she wants? Maybe. Is it that she's now got a dead husband and an illegitimate child, and she's kind of damaged goods, if you would, and she has no other option than to go be with the king? Yes? So, again, y'all figure it out. Every one of the situations where we see kind of Bathsheba's story played out, there's really a fork in the road at every point, and you don't know maybe what the motive is, okay? So, David brings her in. takes her as his wife, one of his now, are we at 11, are we at 16, I don't know, but he's got a slew. But the thing in verse 27 that kind of reigns over this, listen to these words, but the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. So David at this point in the story is off kind of scot-free, right? The timing with the baby isn't perfect, but it's good enough. Uriah's dead. She's with child. Okay, David is mourning and now brings her in as his wife and looks like he's doing the noble thing by being kind of the kinsman redeemer or whatever it may be. And at the end of this, like, man, situationally, he's golden, right? More or less. Problem is in end of verse 27. God knows what's going on. And in chapter 12 now, we're going to see the rest of the story painted, okay? By the way, we know from at least the context of what's going on here, this story occurs later. We're not talking about a week. We're not talking about a month. We're probably talking about years later. Some commentators believe 2 to 3 years later. After David's sin with Bathsheba, Uriah is killed, baby is born. There's a 2 to 3 year period before Nathan the prophet here in chapter 12 steps in and says, hey, we need to talk. We need to have a conversation. So you've got David again now leading a nation. He is internally compromised. He's covering up sin. We see kind of the age of the child. That's the best timeline measurement we have. So we're not sure, but I kind of believe that is the case. It's probably a couple years after this sin that David thinks, man, I'm all good. I'm in the clear. Nothing's going to happen. However, chapter 12, verse 1. Now, we're going to be introduced to a guy by Nathan the prophet. We've seen him before. He's the same guy that David said, hey, can I build a house for the Lord? And Nathan says, yeah, green light. And then God speaks to him and says, no. So this is a guy that God speaks to, and he's a counselor of David. Man, he is a 120% persister. He sees things black and white in his world. Yet, he's brilliant in the way that he's going to confront David. And I want you to see how he does this, because this is really, really smart. Okay, Dave Hollis, pick up 12 verse 1 if you don't mind. All right, so Nathan tells a story, right? Can you guys see the characters in the story just as we read it? There were two men in one city. Who are the men? Uriah and David. One rich and one poor, okay? Obviously, the rich one is David. The poor one is Uriah. The rich man had a great many flocks and herds, maybe 15 at this point, okay? What are we talking about here with his flocks and herds? Obviously, David's women and wives and concubines on top of that. We don't know how many. The poor man had nothing except one little female lamb, okay? Who's the female lamb? Bathsheba, right? He doesn't have concubines. He doesn't have other wives. He's got one. He brought her, nourished her, cared for her. So you get the idea that there's this intimacy between them. It would eat of his bread, drink of his cup, lie in his bosom. It was like a daughter to him, right? So you see what Nathan's doing, right? He's drawing you in, drawing David in with a story and painting this picture because he's wanting now a response from David. He wants him to own and feel this story. David doesn't know at this point that this is a story per se. This could very legitimately be, David, this is happening in your kingdom. This happened. Now speak into this as the king and tell me how we're going to exact judgment, okay? Now, verse 4, we get a new character introduced to the story. Hawes, keep going.
Now, there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the guest who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him.
All right, stop right there. Okay, so that's end of story, okay? A traveler came to the rich man. Who's the traveler in the story? Not Nathan, because it happened before this. He's the only person in the story that doesn't have a one-for-one, like, okay, that guy's that guy, this girl's that girl, right? The traveler is what it seems odd. Now, the traveler came to the man. He was unwilling to take from his own flock to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, he took to the poor man. Now, it may just be the story falling out, right? We need a reason to now take a lamb, okay? I wonder if the traveler isn't a picture of sin becoming, bearing fruit now in David's life. And the opportunity now has presented itself, just like it did with Bathsheba, and confronted now with sin, you've got to make a choice, okay? And what was the choice of the rich man? He disregards all his own sheep, steals the one little ewe lamb from the poor man, sacrifices it, and now offers it to the rich man, okay? Now, David is clearly emotionally invested in this story. Verse 5, somebody pick up there. Watch how David now responds. Okay, pause right there. Okay? How's David respond?
Appropriately,
okay? Maybe. What's the first thing we see? Anger, right? Is that good? Yeah, he's angry at the situation. That's a righteous anger. That is wrong. That is not okay. You do not steal from another. You don't take someone else's stuff. That's wrong. So you see initially a righteous anger. Okay? We don't know this is an adultery issue at this point. This is simply a theft issue, okay? And he says what? What should the punishment be? He shall surely die. Now, walk me through. Y'all know Leviticus, like the back of your hand. What is the punishment for theft in Leviticus? According to the Mosaic law, if you steal from your neighbor, what do you do? Very good. 20% interest, right? So you return what you took plus 20%, okay? That would have been the requirement of the law. So David, how does he respond?
Not appropriately.
Way overboard. Way over emotive, right? Why would David respond that way? Why would he be so angry? Why would he say, man, I know that guy stole a piece of bubble gum, but dude, kill him. That's basically what he's saying. This is a lamb. Now, it's not right. The story is, I mean, we're clearly got a guy that's in sin, that's done something wrong, but David's response is way too far according to the law. Why?
We're talking about it in our regen group,
mm-hmm.
and how, like, the same sin that we have, we tend to look really down on it when we see it in other people.
Very good. I think that's exactly what's going on. And I think David, in a sense, Andre's not just that, but I think he's also trying to distance himself from that sin, to not be a part of it. So he's weighing judgment on this as if to say, that's horrible. I would never do such a thing. That person should be killed. Are you with me? And I think we all kind of have ways of doing that in our own lives where we try to distance ourselves and make something, man, that's anathema. That's horrible. Like, God forbid, kill that guy. You with me? So I think that's dead on.
Or...
Hey, Haley, that's actually very insightful, okay? And let's, sometimes you say very insightful things. Honestly, that's a great observation. I want you to keep that in mind as we roll through the rest of the story, okay? Specifically the chapters that are to come. David is bearing guilt for sure over this decision. We know he's a man after God's own heart. We know he cares. He's not some hard-hearted, you know, this isn't King Ahab that we're talking about that just doesn't give a rip about God or anything. This guy actually has a tender heart. And you know, somewhere down deep, he's bothered by this. But he hasn't done anything, okay? So, he flies off the handle. He must make, verse 6, restitution for the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and had no compassion. So he goes on to a little bit of the law, kill him plus payback. And the fourfold idea was, again, 4 to 5 times the, you know, the amount that was stolen, which wouldn't have been completely inappropriate, but, you know, it still is a little bit above and beyond what the requirements of the law would say in Exodus 22, okay? Now, Nathan is going to change the whole story. He's going to flip it in an instant, okay? And the brilliance of how Nathan did this is he sucked David into the story. He's made him make an authoritative decision. Like, he's weighed in on the matter as a king. And David says the words that you have all heard before in verse 7. You are the man. You're the rich guy. Uriah's the poor guy. Bathsheba's the lamb. You took what you did not have rights to and stole from another man. It is you, okay? And then Nathan goes on to say, man, this is what God says about this matter. Listen, if this isn't just painful to listen to from Nathan, knowing these words came from God. Is it not I who anointed you king over Israel? Is it not I who delivered you from the hand of Saul? I gave you your master's house, your master's wives, into your care. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have added to you many more things like these. David, had I not blessed you enough, I would have given you even more. If that, in your estimation, you didn't have enough blessing for me, I would have heaped out shovels full of more blessing on you had you just asked, right? Like, but you took. Haunting, okay? Why have you despised his word, the word of the Lord, by doing evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite, and now we're getting into the details. With the sword, you have taken his wife to be your wife. You have killed him with the sword of Amnon. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me, have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Notice that her name isn't mentioned. It's not Bathsheba. It's the wife of Uriah the Hittite, right? The same words that David heard at the beginning of this. Isn't this the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Over and over and over again in the story, that's how she is named, as if to say they are one, and you've blown this. So, in the midst of all of this, God knows sin has a way of finding itself out. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. Who is the evil that's going to raise up from him in his own household, by the way? Absalom. Absalom's going to rebel. His oldest son, his son is going to rebel against him. Amnon's his oldest. But evil is going to come from his own household. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he shall lie with your wives in broad daylight. Absalom is going to sleep with David's wives and his concubines on a rooftop palace for the world to see, just like Reuben did, and other characters in Scripture that we have seen that are making a play for the throne. Absalom is going to do this unabashedly and just in broad daylight. Okay. Indeed, you did it in secret, but I will do this thing before all of Israel under the sun. Now, again, here is one of the things that makes David a man after God's own heart. Verse 13. Haley, read that. Now, this is important, okay? There are no excuses. There's no justification. There's no rationalization. David owns his sin, okay? And what's Nathan's response? Immediately.
Forgiven.
You're forgiven. You're forgiven, right? If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to cleanse us from, to remove our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness, right? 1 John 5, whatever it is. It's beautiful, right? There's no condition. There's no, you got to earn it. David is immediately forgiven. Now, are there consequences to his actions?
Yes.
Absolutely. But he is forgiven.
You think maybe you're giving David a little too much credit in the situation? It's been like 3 years. And somebody had to come to him and literally say, I know.
Yeah.
For him to like own up to it.
Yeah, good, better, best. It would have been great if David confessed on his own. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, he confesses. I don't love this, but it's better than maybe, yeah, it's not ideal, but it is what it is, okay?
I find it funny how he sentenced himself to death earlier, and then it's like, under your law, you're dead.
Yeah, exactly. Remember that. And that's the struggle. So you're going to see David wrestle with something underneath the surface, and this is what's stemming from it. How does David feel about his sin? He said it. Death. I should be killed for this. I mean, he feels that deeply over it, that shameful over it, yet he obviously doesn't want to enact his justice system on himself, but that at the end of the day is how David feels about this matter. Like, he feels that busted up about it. Now, he still did it, and he's still got to pay the piper in the sense of that he's going to reap the consequences of what he sowed, but God's forgiven him. Now, this is what David can't process. He can't quite understand, how can God forgive me when my sin is that great? I've killed a man. I took what was not mine. I committed adultery. How can God just, how can he forgive me, right? Do you guys ever wrestle with that? Like when you're wrestling with your own sin and filth, like I do, and say, Lord, how can I just confess? How can I just be honest with you about where I'm at and then just move on? Like, how are you that gracious with me? You see, we have this perception that God is like other people and that, yeah, there may be spoken forgiveness, but it's not really forgiveness. You're going to have to earn back that relationship with me, that trust with me, and some of that's legitimate, right? When you break trust, that happens. But we see God like a human sometimes with our own faults and our own, like, how would we handle that situation? And David can't get there in his head. And you're going to see that flesh itself out in the story. David is still wrestling with that. He has not forgiven himself for what he did, and he can't understand how God could either, to be honest with you. And I think he's leading from that position. Now, how do you think David's going to do as a leader when he's wrestling with that stuff under the surface? Terrible. You can't lead from that position. You can't lead when you're dealing with your own issues and speak into things if you haven't forgiven yourself. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have sin, but David is, I think he's stuck here. So we'll watch the text unfold as we get there, okay? Now, God's mad, obviously, he's forgiven him, but, you know, he's basically said, listen, God's frustrated because, verse 14, you have given occasion of the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. Like, David, you've made God look bad here because of your actions, and the enemies of the Lord are not just looking down on you, they're looking down on God. Yes, Stephen. Yeah, that's a tough one. I would say that he inherited Saul's concubines. Now, is God saying, yeah, and you should take him as wives and sleep with them all? I don't think so. I think he's saying, listen, Saul's house now became your house. Servants, wives, right? I don't know that he was instantly married to all of them, but it's like, listen, yes, I gave you the inheritance of Saul, all of them. So, they are named as wives. I don't think that's what God is communicating here. I don't think this is a reversal on monogamy, if you will. Does that make sense? So, yeah. Okay. So, as a result, verse 14, the child that is born to you shall surely die. These are the consequences of David's sin. So because of this, this is a really, really hard consequence. God loves him. God has completely forgiven him. Yet, God, in some instances, is going to make David and us walk in our own consequences. Sometimes God chooses to remove those. Sometimes God says, no, you're going to get to sit in those, and you're going to get to live in them. And David's going to live in this one, okay? Nathan went to his house. The Lord struck the child that Uriah's widow bore to David, that he was very sick. David inquired of God for the Lord. He fasted and prayed and wept on the ground. Again, I'll kind of fast forward through the story a little bit, but David is a complete wreck. He finds out the kid is sick, and he's moving quickly towards death. David prays. He weeps. He fasts. And he is an absolute nightmare physically. Servants come to him and say, man, the kid's died. Like, do we even tell David? He's so bad right now. If we tell him, this may be the thing that pushes him over the cliff and, like, ruins his life forever. They tell him, and David gets up, washes his face, takes a bath, changes his clothes, and acts like everything is good when they tell him his kid is dead. And, like, how is this, like, if you did this beforehand, and they ask him as much, like, how are these actions consistent? And David says in verse 22, while the child was still alive, I fasted and wept and said, who knows? The Lord may be gracious to me that the child may live. I'm going to intercede on his behalf. I'm going to pray. I'm going to beg God because God may change his mind. He may change not his will or his direction per se, but he could change his direction in this matter. Okay. But now that the child has died, why should I fast? He's dead. What's happened has happened. I can't bring him back. And he says as much. Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, meaning I'm going to die one day. I'll join him in death, but he will not return to me. He's not going to become born again. He's not going to come back from the dead. So what is what is, okay? So that's, I think, what David is kind of communicating. So there's some theological stuff with infant salvation here that we won't necessarily get into, but there's some interesting texts that we can go to in the scriptures that, that don't make that super clear, but this is one where people will point and say, maybe David sees it as one day he's going to return to him and see him again, i.e. the infant salvation. I don't think this is what David's primarily dealing with here. I don't know that it's wrong to say that. Pastorally, that's a very difficult issue. But I think David's just saying, look, the kid's dead. I'm going to join him in death one day. He's not going to come back to me. It is what it is. God chose his path, and I got to wash my hands of this, and I got to deal with it. This is the reality that I'm living in, okay?
What do you think about infant salvation? Just quick, like, 2 seconds.
I think it was a lot easier to take a stand on it biblically until I sat in rooms with husbands and wives that had lost kids. In seminary, when it was he's and she's and hypotheticals, it was very clean. When I sat with people that had lost kids, you realize this isn't just a pronoun. This is their child. I see room in the text for it. I wouldn't take a bullet for it, but I see room in the text for it.
Thank you.
Yep. So, David says, comforts his wife Bathsheba. He went into her. Bathsheba now has a second child whose name is Solomon. 25, Jedidiah is his other name. This is the future king of Israel. So God, even in the midst of this, is gracious. Okay, so he allows Bathsheba to conceive, has another son, and that's the idea. Okay, 26 and following, Joab is still at war. Okay, the rest of the story is continuing. David is at home, kind of all jacked, and basically Joab. And this is what I love about Joab, okay? He's exactly what David needs and is exactly what David doesn't need, okay? Watch what he says. Look, somebody pick up verse 27. This is what Joab's advice is to David. Not even advice, just this is what he tells him to do.
And Joab sent messengers to David and said, I have fought against Rabbah. Moreover, I have taken the city of waters. Now then, gather the rest of the people together and encamp against the city and take it, lest I take the city and it be called by my name.
David's, or Joab's saying, I've taken the city, I've taken their water source. Okay, we're 99% done with the battle. Get off the couch, get out here, come fight a battle with me, do the last 1% so the people can see you as a warrior, take the city. And if you don't, I'm going to name the city after me. It's going to be called City of Joab. So you see what Joab's doing? Dude, quit mourning. Like, let's go. You've got to get out of this, David, at some point and return to life, right? He's urging him to move forward. David does it, comes, wins the battle, right? He does kind of he's the ceremonial guy that comes in and, you know, like pulls his sword out. Oh, I don't know what he does. But David ends up getting the glory, and that's what kind of Joab wants. So he ultimately calls him kind of out of that. They take the city. David gets all this stuff, and David and all the people at the end of verse 31 return to Jerusalem with the spoil, and David is kind of now trying to re-enter back into life after this, okay? But he's still wrestling with this underneath the surface. Now, 13 is a horrible chapter, okay? We've seen this chapter in Genesis in a different light, but it's the same situation. This is a rape scenario. This is what we're looking at. Tamar is about to get violated by her half-brother, and it's a terrible situation. And part of this is the result of David's, it's not David's fault. This is the aftermath of David leading really, really poorly in his family, okay? So just to prepare you guys emotionally for what's coming. It was after this in verse 13, verse 1, that Absalom, the son of David, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. Absalom and Tamar are full blood brother and sister, okay? Amnon, the son of David, loved her. So Amnon is a half-brother of these two. Amnon is Tamar's half-brother, their half-brother's sister, right? And then Absalom and her are full-blood brother and sister. So it's just important in the story that you kind of understand that. Amnon says he loves her, which probably a better word would be lusts after her. He wants her, verse 2, he was frustrated. This is a sexual frustration over this woman. She was a virgin, and it seemed hard for Amnon to do anything to her. So you see his motives. He wants to sleep with his half-sister, okay? He gets some really bad advice from a guy named Jonadab in verse 3 who says, hey, fake like you're sick. Ask David permission for her to come into your room, cook you whatever, take care of you while you're sick. And he says, man, that's a great idea. So Amnon in verse 6 lays down, tells David, hey, I feel really bad. Have my half-sister cooked me breakfast, right? And she does that. David commands it. He takes from her in verse 9 the pan which she had given him and then says, have everyone go out for me. So now it's her, Tamar, and Amnon in the room, half-brother, half-sister, alone. And Amnon basically says, come lie with me in verse 11. He makes his intentions very, very clear. I want to sleep with you, okay, right now. And in verse 12, she very clearly answers how she feels about that situation. Somebody read that.
No, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done, and do not do this outrageous thing.
All right, and that is exactly, no, my brother, do not violate me. Do not rape me. That is not what I want. So she is very clear. Now, she realizes she's stuck because it's her and him. There are no witnesses. There's no one that can prove this if it goes down. And she's gonna offer anything she can in this moment to get out of the situation, okay? As for me, where can I get rid of my approach? So she's thinking, hey, think about me. Like, if you sleep with me, again, forgive the terminology, but I'm damaged goods. No one's going to marry me. I'm a virgin, and my life is basically ruined. As for you, you will be like one of the fools in Israel. Think about yourself. Like, your reputation is going to be ruined. Now, therefore, please speak to the king, for he will not withhold you from me. What does that mean?
Ask the king and I'll be given to you.
Yeah, as a wife. Like, gosh, if you have to have this, let's at least do it right. Now, is that what she wants? Clearly not. She's trying to get out of the situation. But she's saying, hey, I will even become your wife. Like, let's just do this the right way. So she's...
Cool to marry your half-sister?
No. It's a violation of the law. Okay, so no. She's trying to get out of the situation. She's what any woman would do in this situation. Like, look, I'll cut off a finger for you right now. Like, what do you need, right? I just want out. He, in verse 14, would not listen to her since he was stronger than her. He violated her and lay with her. And that means exactly what we think it is. He rapes her, okay? This is of no fault of hers at all. He violates her. Amnon hated her, verse 15, with a very great hatred, and says to her at the end of verse 15, get up, go away. Wait, I thought you loved her. So obviously this is lust. It's nothing more. It's his flesh. He sleeps with her, rapes her, and then commands her to leave. Basically kicks her out of the house, calls his young servant in and says, get this woman out of my presence. And the story unfolds from there. Verse 20, Absalom, Tamar's full-blood brother, hears about this and says, has Amnon, your brother, been with you? Has he slept with you? But now keep silent, my sister, for he is your brother. Do not take this matter to heart. Tamar remained, and Absalom was desolate in her brother Absalom's house. So Absalom takes her in. For some reason, she doesn't go to David's house and stay with her father. Absalom finds out about it, and you get the idea that Absalom understands the intent of Amnon. He's seen this before. He's seen the way he's looked at her, acted with her, knows his character, that this is typical. Now, in 21, watch who finds out about this.
When King David heard of all these things, he was very angry.
Ah, okay. Is that a correct response to the situation? Absolutely. Okay, he is very angry. What should come next? According to the law, if you rape a woman, death. Okay, the law is very clear. Death. But Absalom did not speak of Amnon, either good or bad. The story ends with David. He does nothing. He hated Amnon because he violated his sister. Now about after 2 full years, and the story goes on, David does nothing. Why would David not act right now? Absolutely. Okay, I think that's the deeper meaning here. I mean, on the surface, you've got Amnon as firstborn. This is the guy that's supposed to get the throne. Why would I kill Amnon, right? So that's having to put your own son to death but have its own issues in and of itself, guilty or not, right? That will be difficult. I think the deeper thing, Stephen, and that's really what's going on, David doesn't feel the moral authority to make that judgment because he knows he's done that much and then some. I took a woman that wasn't mine. I violated her. And then I had a man killed to cover up my sin. A child lost his life as a result of my sin. And I've wrecked a whole household over this. How in the world can I speak into this? How do I deal with that? Has God forgiven David?
Yes,
unequivocally. But has David forgiven David?
No.
No. And that's what we're wrestling with here. So David does not act. Now, as a result of his inability to manage his household, after 2 years, Absalom looks around and says, look, Dad's not going to do anything. I got to take matters into my own hand. And how do you think a young man with a lot of testosterone who's been penting up anger for 2 years over his half-brother and his dad not doing anything is going to handle this?
Very bad.
Yeah, he's going to fly off the handle. So he's going to have Amnon murdered. And that's exactly what he does. He sets up a situation, comes to Dad and say, hey, Amnon's shearing his sheep. Let me go to him and help him. David's like, huh? Like, he knows that they're not good. But Amnon, Absalom gives him the story. He says, no. I need to go, you know, see how he is and check on him. And David says, okay. And he does. And Absalom comes now to Amnon with his servants. Verse 29, the servants of Absalom did to Amnon just as Absalom had commanded, which was go kill him. So Absalom sends now his buddies now basically to come in, and they take Amnon's life. They kill him. And that was the just punishment for Amnon's sin. That's what should have happened. It shouldn't have happened in some, like, this shouldn't have been the way it happened, but that was the correct ultimate punishment, okay? Verse 30, David gets now the report. He gets an initial report that Absalom killed all of his sons, and then he gets a second report that says, oh, no, it's actually just Absalom had killed just Amnon. And he's comforted in that and finds out in verse 33 that only Amnon is dead. And Absalom now, because of this, fled and went to Talmai, or whatever that is, and flees basically away from David. And David's now left in this conundrum. In 38, Absalom had fled there, gone to Geshur, and was there for 3 years. The heart of David longed to go out for Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon since he was dead. What does that mean? Exactly. Justice has been served. He's like, that's the right thing. But now what do I do with Absalom? So now he's got issues not just with himself, but Absalom's had to take justice into his own hands because David wouldn't act. But he doesn't want to bring Absalom back because now this looks weird because now he's going to reinstate a murderer into his kingdom. How does that look to everyone else around me? And then, like, how do I feel about my son being murdered? Like, regardless of his crime, I still love him. That's my firstborn son. And my third or fourth born son, I forget where Absalom sits, I think he's third, murdered my firstborn son. Like, David's in a conundrum. And Absalom, what is Absalom on at this point? Probably for David to bring him back and for David to say what to him?
Good job.
At the very least, I'm sorry I put you in this situation. Your actions were more righteous than mine. Maybe you should have handled it this way, and I should have done a better job. I love you. I accept you. We talk about in men's fraternity, for those of you guys that have been through it, it's a study that kind of walks through dudes' issues, and there's kind of some wounds that we talk about that guys have to deal with in their past. One of them is a father wound. A lot of guys have jacked relationships with their dads, and they flesh themselves out today. Absalom is the quintessential guy that walks around with a father wound. For the rest of his days, his actions are going to be motivated out of this lack of relationship with Dad. Because David didn't bring him back. David didn't accept him. All he wants is his father to say, I love you. I forgive you. We're okay. And that would have solved the problem. Except David just says, man, and he leaves him kind of hung out to dry. Lets him come back in. Doesn't kill him. Doesn't enact justice or a vendetta or whatever. But he doesn't accept him either. And Absalom is deeply, deeply wounded over this. So, and he's conflicted as a young man. Like, this was the right thing to do. And yet my dad won't commend me for that or even acknowledge the fact that I did it. Won't even speak with him. Okay. So as you think through the lens of Absalom, he's dealing with his own U-Haul full of stuff, as is David. And they're all kind of jacked in the head, if you will. Okay. Now, 14, here's another reason where I absolutely love Joab. Okay. Pick up there. 14:1. Okay, pause for there for a second. So what's Joab realize?
That David
is Absalom. He wants to extend grace to Absalom. He wants to forgive him, but he can't. He's stuck, right? So Joab sees David's heart and says, man, you need to make this right, but you're stuck and he's stuck. And David, this is on you. You've got to move past this. Now, again, what's inhibiting David from moving forward? At the end of the day,
his own guilt,
his own sin over his own situations. And he won't extend himself to Absalom. So Joab brilliantly is going to set the table. He's going to create a scene. He's going to make a situation occur where David, just like Nathan did, instead of a story, he's going to create a real life story. And David is going to be a marionette in his story. And he's going to force David to deal with his own issues and to deal with Absalom. It's brilliant. So he takes this wise woman from a Tekoa, and he says, please pretend, in verse 2, to be a mourner. Put on mourning garments now. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but be like a woman who has been in mourning for the dead for many days. Look like you're going to a funeral. Look like you've been there for a long time. Then go to the king and speak to him in this matter. Say exactly what I tell you to say. And this is what she is told to say. Let's see. We're about to find out. Okay, so she now comes before the king, before King David. And she tells the story in verse 6 of this hypothetical thing that Joab has put in her mouth. So I'm going to pick up in verse 6. Okay, so we got two sons fighting. There was nobody to intercede. One killed the other. Is that right?
No.
No, you got a guilty son who has killed another son. Okay, it's not a good situation. Keep going. All right, so what is she saying? I have one surviving son, and the right thing to do with this murderous son is to do what? What's the law say? You kill somebody, you die. Okay, that's what the law says. However, what would happen if we killed this woman's only remaining son? The heir is gone, extinguish my coal, like I have no life. That's all the possessions I have, right? Do you see the situation that David is being put in? David, you had two sons. One clearly did wrong, okay? And as a result, one of the sons, Absalom, now murders Amnon. He murdered another person without court of law, without the procedure that the Levitical law would call for. So the punishment for this murderer should be what?
Death.
Absalom should die because this was handled incorrectly. So David's now stuck. You see how he's living this. He's feeling this. This isn't just a story to him. So in verse 8, the king says, go to your house and I will give orders concerning you. She asks, David, weigh in. As the king, make a judgment. David says, go home and I'll give you orders. What does that mean? Half full version, I got to think about it. Half empty version? What's that? I'm not worrying about it. Why does David not want to weigh in on this matter? It hits way too close to home. He doesn't want to deal with it. So he's blowing her off. Go home. I'll write you a letter. I'll get back to you. I'll call you. That's what he's saying. He's never going to call her. He's never going to weigh in. He's never going to do anything. He doesn't want to have to deal with this because he's got to deal with Absalom. What else does he have to deal with of someone who murdered another man? He's got to deal with his own stuff, right? And he feels like he can't move on either. So, and he's already weighed in. Kill that guy that took the, right? We already know where David stands on this. He thinks death should be the appropriate thing in all these, in every situation, himself included. Now the woman's going to up it, an ante. The woman of Tekoa said to the king, oh, my lord, the king, the iniquity is on me and my father's house, but the king and his throne are guiltless. What is she saying? This is my issue. David, weigh in on this. I just need you to make judgment. Like, hey, you're righteous. You're the king. Speak to this. You're the only person who can. Whoever speaks to you, bring him to me, and he will not touch you anymore. Verse 10 is what now David says. Whoever speaks to you, bring him to me, and he will not touch the man anymore. Therefore, in verse 11, she says, please let the king remember the Lord your God, so that the avenger of blood may not continue to destroy. Otherwise, they will destroy my son. Okay? If we continue down this road of vengeance, it's just going to get worse. There's going to be death and death and death. That's not what we want. And he now says at the end of verse 11, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. This is David's judgment regarding this son who killed the other son. What is he saying?
He won't
die. He's been forgiven. He won't die. That is not the right course of action. Okay? Now, watch this. Tell me if this didn't take some chutzpah. Verse 12. What did David just get, like, hit with upside the head?
Hello?
This is not about my son. This is about your son. And if this is your judgment, if you really feel that the righteous and the godly thing to do, regardless of maybe how you feel internally, is to forgive this son and not kill him, then why won't you extend to yourself the same grace that you're extending to me? Extend that grace to Absalom, and more importantly, extend that grace to yourself. Why have you not brought back the banished one? For we shall surely die, and we are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered again. Yet God does not take away life, yet plans ways so that the banished one may not be cast out for him. David, God's heart is to restore Absalom, is to restore you, to make things right again. And yet you're impeding that by carrying around this guilt over Absalom, guilt over yourself. I mean, this is a beautiful picture. And David gets sucked in, hook, line, and sinker. It's beautiful. And Joab is literally the marionette of this whole thing. This is what David needs. He just needed someone that had the ability to say, I don't care if you're the king. This is what you need. You need to deal with this. And as your friend, I'm going to do something to you that's painful. But this is where you need to go down this road. I'm going to force you to go through the tunnel of chaos or whatever you guys call it in your world. But he makes him deal with this issue of forgiveness, okay? So this is kind of how that story plays out. Verse 17, she goes on to say, please let the word of my Lord, the king, be comforting. For as the angel of God, so is the Lord, the king, to discern good and evil. She's basically saying to David, you've made the right call. What you've said is correct. Now you have to go live it. You need to forgive Absalom and forgive yourself. Okay, so I think this is what David has been wrestling with the whole time. Okay, the king answered and said to the woman, please do not hide anything from me that I'm about to ask you. So he now turns to the table and says, listen, I need to ask you a question. She says, let the Lord speak. And in verse 19, he says, is this the hand of Joab with you in all of this? Did Joab put you up to this? David knows. And she basically says, yeah. And in verse 19, it was he who put all these words in the mouth of your maidservant. He's behind this. Okay, he's forced my hand. Okay, and David realizes that in this moment, Joab is a great friend of David. Okay, and again, this is why I'm so conflicted over Joab, because he's just this is exactly what David needs. But in other situations, he's a complete loose cannon because David won't discipline him. Okay. Now in verse 21, David says, "I will surely do this thing. Go therefore, bring back the young man Absalom." So what's David's resolve at the end of this?
Bring him back.
Bring back my son. Okay? Joab arose, went to Geshur, brought Absalom back in verse 23 to Jerusalem. However, he says now, let him turn to his own house and let him not see my face. So Absalom turned to his own house and did not see the king's face. David brings him back to Jerusalem, but what? Why? Yeah, I think he's still dealing with the guilt that he's carrying over this. He doesn't still know how to respond. So he's jacked, okay? It's a very, very difficult situation, okay? Absalom longs for his father. Verse 28, he lived 2 full years in Jerusalem and did not see the king's face. Absalom is growing bitter. He's growing frustrated. You can imagine all this guy wants is to see his dad. Dad doesn't want to see him. And they live next door to one another, right? It's a horrible story. Absalom now in verse 29 sends for Joab and says, man, I want to see my dad. sends the second time to Joab and basically says, man, I want to see him. Tell me if this isn't typical of a kid that is not getting his father's attention. Read verse 30. Have you guys seen this? When kids are not getting the affection and the attention that they need from parents, they do one of two things. They either go get straight A's and live a perfect life so that they will be esteemed in their parents' eyes as a goody-goody-two-shoes or perfect, or mom or dad will be proud of me because of the medals and accolades on my wall. Or, we've talked about this before, I will rebel in such a crazy way that they will be forced to pay attention to me. Absalom sets Joab's field on fire. That's basically like taking his income and saying, I'm draining your bank account, right? This is a big, audacious, visible to all, like, action. I mean, so Absalom goes down that road. You're going to pay attention to me. And it works. David is forced now to deal with him. So Joab arose, came to Absalom and said, dude, you're an idiot. Why have you done this? And Absalom says, look, I sent you. I told you to come here. You didn't. Why have I come from Beshur, or from Geshur, where you brought me from? It would be better for me to still be there. You brought me to Jerusalem to see my dad, and I can't see my dad. What's going on? Now, therefore, he says, let me see the king's face, and if there is iniquity in me, then let him put me to death. Like, it's one way or the other. Either I'm guilty or I'm not guilty, but I'm in purgatory right now because he will not deal with me. He's brought me close, but he's not restored me. David now in verse 33 calls for Absalom. Thus he came to the king, prostrated himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. So they finally have this moment where David fully embraces him, has dealt with it, and I don't know all the baggage that he's carrying, if it's political, if it's other things to bring in this, you know, how everyone else would have viewed Absalom, but it's too little, too late. He is so wounded, his son, and not granting him the forgiveness that he needed, that Absalom is just angry. And in verse 15, or chapter 15 and following, Absalom is now going to rebel. And David is the one who's going to cause this. Do you remember the punishment that Nathan said was coming for David regarding the sword? It's going to devour your house. What you had in Camelot was peace. And I'm now going to bring the opposite of that. And David, these are the consequences of your actions. So this is David's fault, if you will. This is the consequence of David's sin. Okay, now Absalom is brilliant. He is a politician. He is he knows how to do what he's doing. In chapter 15, watch how he does this. 15:1. Somebody pick up there. Okay, so what is Absalom doing in 15:1? What is this a picture of?
He's undermining his dad's authority.
Okay, why chariots? Why horses? Why 50 men? What is he putting on display of?
He has
power. Power, okay. And then he goes to the where in verse 2?
City gate.
The gate. What happens in city gates?
The leaders stay there.
Business, everybody. As people are coming in from outside the city, he'd say, hey, what's going on? What do you need? Oh, you have this issue. Oh, there's nobody here to hear you issue. If you had a good king, he would be here. He would be listening to the needs of his people. Oh, that people would make me king. And then I would hear your issues and I would listen to you. I would be a good king. Do you see what he's doing? He's just slowly, strategically winning the hearts of the people. Isn't this what you want? You want somebody to hear your needs and take care of you? I'm here for you. He's a politician, right? And then slowly but surely, I think it's the text says, verse 7, my text says 40 years, it's 4 years. Absalom has basically taken the pendulum of, the straw poll, and he's moved it all the way to the other side. So people are getting frustrated with David because he's not there. He's not acting. And Absalom is saying, if I were king, I would do this. And once Absalom has seen this thing tip and the people fall in love with him, in verse 6, Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. And he realizes there's a day that he's in charge, maybe not in title, but everyone's going to follow him. And all that matters at this point is he's got to take that last step of 100 steps. Bring a coup about, and the people will follow him. And that's exactly what he does. Okay, he brings counselors. He brings people with him. And he says in verse 9, let's see. Verse 10, Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom is king in Hebron. So he kind of rallies these people. 200 men went with Absalom in verse 11 to Jerusalem. Ahithophel, by the way, goes with him as well. Anybody got a note on who Ahithophel is?
Counselor of David, who is considered a man who considered the word of God.
Okay, he's that, and he's also
the grandfather of
Bathsheba. How about that? So Ahithophel was like Midas. Anything he said came true. He had the golden touch, okay? Ahithophel is the guy you want giving you counsel. He steals Ahithophel's heart away, probably because what David had done to his granddaughter, and now they are going to conspire, okay? Verse 13, the hearts of the men of Israel with Absalom. He rebels. David said to all his servants who were with him in Jerusalem, arise, let us flee, for otherwise none of us will escape from Absalom. So David now has, again, this decision to make. Do I fight my son? Do I let him in? And David basically says, man, the heck with it. Okay, so I'm going to leave. Verse 16, the king went out, all his household with him, but he left 10 concubines to keep the house. So he leaves servants in charge of the house that he's living in Jerusalem, but he and his people leave. Okay, he crosses now in verse 16, or 18 rather, the Kidron Valley, goes up over the Mount of Olives. He gets a group of people that follow him. 600 men, Gittites, or men from Gath, go with David, who probably were part of his renegade band as he was getting pursued by Saul, men that are loyal to him. Verse 19, a guy by the name of Ittai the Gittite. We were getting ready, by the way, to have Ella a number of years ago when we were teaching through this text. So it's March now. Ella was born in April. So it's kind of the same pattern every year as to what book we're in. And this guy Ittai is like awesome, right? He's super faithful. He's from Gad, but he's loyal to David. Basically, David says, dude, go home. Stay in Jerusalem. Like, dude, it's going to be hard following me. You've done this before. Don't do this. And Ittai's like, no, I'm coming with you. And I told Michelle, I'm like, this guy's awesome. We should name our kid Ittai if he's a male. And Michelle's like, you've had way too much coffee. Like, no, that is a really stupid idea. So thankfully, Ella was a girl, and we didn't name her Ittai. So anyway, I like this guy. He's super loyal. David says, go home. Ittai in 21 says, as the Lord lives, as my Lord the King lives, surely wherever my Lord the King be, whether for death or for life, there also your servant will be. David, I'm following you. End of story. Okay, I don't care how hard it is. They're crossing over into the desert. He doesn't want any part of leaving him home. Okay, so David leaves. The whole country is in mourning. They're weeping with a loud voice in verse 23. They cross over the Kidron, go into the wilderness. It's a bad situation. Okay, so he just decides, man, I'm not going to fight my son. It is not worth it. And then Zadok, who is the current priest, comes out with David with the Ark of God, right? And David says to him in verse 25, return the Ark of God to the city. If I find favor in the sight of the Lord, then he will bring me back again and show me his habitation. So David has the opportunity to take the Ark of God out of Jerusalem with him. And what does he say?
Leave it there.
Leave it there. Why would you do that? That's a pretty big, like, in reality, Lord, I'm getting kicked out of my house. The Ark of God would have been a lucky rabbit's foot to some. And he says, man, leave it there. Like, man, God's going to resolve this. So that's a pretty big statement of, man, I'm not going to fight for the throne. I can let go of this easy. And if God wants me back in, he'll take me. But I'm not going to take the Ark of God with me. That's not the right thing to do. And God says, David says, God will bring me back if that's his ultimate delight. Okay. He says, if I have no delight in you, behold, I am here, then let him do what seems good to him. Like, man, if God doesn't want me back, then he's going to put another guy on the throne. It is what it is, okay? So they cross over. David goes over in verse 30, the Mount of Olives, weeps as he went with his head covered, and he walked barefoot. So they are in mourning, okay? Now, David was told that Ahithophel basically stayed with Absalom. His number one counselor stays with Absalom. And David brings this guy in named Hushai, the Archite, who apparently has counseling skills just like Ahithophel, and says, listen, I need you to not come with me. I need you to stay with Absalom and fake like you're on Absalom's team. You're going to be a mole for me. And anything that Ahithophel says, any counsel that he gives to Absalom in regards to what to do next, you've got to counteract that. And your advice has to seem to Absalom better than Ahithophel's advice. Okay, so David's wise in how he does this and says, listen, you're going to be a spy. End of verse 34, thwart the counsel of Ahithophel for me. Okay, I need you to stay. And that's exactly what this guy does. Okay, so in chapter 16, we read this yesterday. This is the story of Mephibosheth. David's leaving town. Ziba comes to him. Thanks for all the stuff. Thanks for the apples. Where's Mephibosheth? Oh, he gave you the double bird and on. Okay. Another guy, let's see, in verse 5, named Shimei comes out. This guy is a chump. Verse 6, watch what this guy does. Because David's leaving town.
And he threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David. And all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left.
So David's leaving town, and this guy basically walks next to him and just curses him and throws stones at him. Verse 7, get out, you man of bloodshed, you worthless fellow. The Lord has returned upon you the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. I mean, this guy is just going off on David. He has opportunity, and he just rails on David. So I call him the cursing mooner. I don't know what else he was doing. I imagine he was mooning David as well. Just in my head, that's what's playing out. So this guy's rude. He's disrespectful. He's taking advantage of the situation. You know, this guy's like one of those keyboard, you know, guys that's going to say anything online, but he does it in person. So he tells David exactly what he thinks, and David just kind of deals with it, and he moves on, okay? Abishai now says to this dude, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over there and cut off his head. I love Abishai. Like, act first, think later. David, can I go cut off his head, please? Can I run Abner through right now while he's laying next to Saul? Please, please, David. And David's like, dude, pull the leash, calm down. Like, Abishai's going to be an interesting guy to meet in heaven as well. So David says, no, man, let God deal with that. So you're seeing now another side of David come out. Part of it, I think, is still a little bit of the funk that grows on David of not dealing with sin when it's there. I think probably the half-full version is he's saying, man, God will deal with that. That's not up to me. I'm not gonna respond to other people's anger and outburst in the same way. That's not right. There's no justice in that. I'm going to be gracious and just, I'll take it. Man, just heap upon me insults and I'll deal with it. Okay? Verse 13, Shimei, this guy that Abishai wants to kill, walks along the hillside parallel with him as he went and cursed him and cast stones and threw dust at him. The king and all the people who were with him arrived weary and he refreshed himself there. So this guy goes alongside of him as long as he can and just curses David. He is a chump. Now, back to Absalom. He's rebelled. He's in the kingdom, okay? And now Ahithophel is going to give him advice. Look at the advice that he gives him. Absalom says, before he gives him advice, Hushai's in the kingdom, and Absalom's like, man, why are you here? Aren't you David's buddy? Like, this doesn't make sense that you're here. Hushai, who's the mole that David's planted in the kingdom, has to convince Absalom, no, I'm really on your team. I just changed teams mid-game, and we're good. Okay, so he basically says, okay, that's good. Ahithophel, now in verse 21, gives David advice. Okay, Absalom advice. This is his advice as to how to become the new king of Israel. 21. All right, so sleep with your father's concubines. Everybody will know that you guys are no longer on the same team. You've made yourself odious in his sight, is what my version says. Verse 22, what do they do?
Pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all of Israel.
I mean, that's pretty bold-faced, like, get out of town, Dad. I could care less about you. And again, where does this all stem from? This is just a kid wanting his dad's approval. This is just a kid that's in need of love and acceptance from his dad. If David had reached out to him 3 years ago and said, man, I love you. I don't approve of what you did. We should have done it differently. But I love you, and I forgive you, and let's move on from this. This situation wouldn't have played out the way it did. This is on David in a lot of ways. Absalom's responsible for his actions. But David is the one that has set the table for this to happen, if you will. Okay? So just, that's a hard one. Okay, verse 23, you get a little note on the advice of Ahithophel. The advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one inquired of the word of God. It was like you were speaking to God himself when you got advice from Ahithophel. Wouldn't that be awesome? Wouldn't you love to have a counselor in your life that was like, God, what would you want? Well, let me tell you, because I know exactly what God, you know, so he's brilliant to have around, okay? Now, here's Ahithophel's advice. Tell me if this isn't brilliant. So Absalom says, okay, slept with the concubines. I'm the new guy on the block. The coup has occurred. Absalom, Ahithophel, what do I do next? This is what he says, 17:1.
Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arrive and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he is weary and discouraged and throw him into a panic. And all the people who are with him will flee, and I will strike down only the king.
Okay, so what's his advice?
Give me men. I'm going to go chase him.
Absolutely. David's weary. He's tired. He's been taking women and children. They're in the desert. Like, they're exhausted. They've had a couple snacks that Ziba gave them, but that's about it. Let's capitalize on the moment right now. We're fresh. We're ready. Let's go after them and kill them, right? That's great advice. If you want to win the battle right now, let's put down the king, okay? Absalom says, now, let's talk to Hushai, okay? Let's see what he says. Now, Hushai's in a jam because he knows, man, that's great advice. That's right advice. Now, I've got to counteract that, and I got to make what I say sound like it's better advice, though I'm lying through my teeth for the sake of David to save his life. Okay. This time, Hushai says in verse 7, the advice that Ahithophel has given is not good. This would be the first time ever that this has happened. And he says to him, you know your father, verse 8, and his men. They are mighty men, and they are fierce like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. And your father is an expert in warfare. He will not spend the night with the people. Behold, he has hidden himself in caves or another place. It will be when he falls upon them and first attacks, and whoever hears of it, there has been a slaughter among the people of Absalom. David's smart. He knows what he's doing, Absalom. He's going to hide in caves. He's going to protect the women and children. And you're going to come into raid, and he's going to come out, and he's going to surround you, and he's going to kill you. He's fresh. He knows what he's doing. You don't want to mess with him. Well, the reality is he's exhausted. He's sleeping in the midst of the women and children to protect them and everyone that's there. So Hushai is lying to him, and now he's confused, okay? And he's going to go on, and now he's going to play to Absalom's pride, okay? Watch this in verse 11.
But my counsel is that all Israel be gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba, and the sand by the sea for multitude, and that you go to battle in person. So we shall come.
Okay, pause right there. So you go to battle. Pause this for a second. Gather all the people from Dan to Beersheba. Send out the letters. Get everyone to rally in. You go lead them, Absalom. Show yourself as the king. Don't send Ahithophel with 12,000 people as your representative. That looks weak, right? You see what he's playing to? Show yourself a king. Look like a warrior. Step in here and lead. That's going to take a couple days to get all the logistics sorted out, but that's what you need to do, right? So he sucked in this young, prideful man. And Absalom, at the end of the story, goes, yeah, I can be the hero of the story. Verse 14, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. That's where Absalom lands.
Okay, so earlier this year we did that thing with Dave about like basically like righteous lying.
Mm-hmm.
The whole, like, you know, did you hear about it where we were in the three sides?
Mm-hmm.
And God blessed it, and she tried to save people.
Yeah.
We were saying, like, is that considered righteous? Is God going to bless that? So now we hear we have another guy lying. Where is the stance on that? Like, he's lying, but it's to save the king, and it's actually in God's will for him to be lying.
What does Dave Haas say?
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I am. Totally, yes.
Yeah, I don't know. This is another tough one when you look at it, because he's being asked by the king, who is, God has put David there as the king, as you look, and so he's the rightful one on the throne. So in a sense, you see, this is not according to God's plan. So that would probably be my first approach, because it would be similar to where I think David's putting Hushai in a tough spot.
It's a hard situation. My wife just took her CBAS test. You guys, so you can sub or whatever. and she had to do a writing portion, and the writing portion was, is being honest the right course of action every time? And she had to write about it.
Who did?
My wife. This was like last week, right? She gets results today, actually. So I'm like, well, what'd you say? She's like, I said it was, honesty is always the best policy. I'm like, really? What do you do with Rahab? I was just messing with her. I probably would have landed in the same spot. I would have said exactly what she did.
That was
so.
The argument that always got brought up in our thing, too, was what about Rahab. But this is a great example of that, too.
Yeah. He's being conniving. He's being dishonest, right? That's not how he really feels. That's a great example. So remember, those are blips on the radar in a huge span of years. I think God's heart is honesty.
Yeah, that's not to justify.
Certainly.
That's a great example.
It is another good example, okay? Now, so word gets out. Hushai wins the debate, if you will. David basically now is told by Hushai's servants, his mole, hey, this is what's happened. This is what's coming. You're safe for a season. I've convinced Absalom to wait, okay? So David now has time to rest and prepare and eat food. Ahithophel is so flabbergasted that his counsel was not taken, because this has never happened. Verse 23, I'm sorry, I'm laughing. I shouldn't be laughing. Watch what this guy does.
Set his house in order and hanged himself, and he died and was buried in the tomb of his father.
Like, dude, you committed suicide because someone didn't take your advice. Like, does that tell you how good his advice was and how he... We talk about maybe your personal identity being wrapped up too much in your job or whatever. He's so distraught by the fact that Absalom's either been deceived or his advice wasn't taken. He goes home and commits suicide. It's a rough day, okay? Anyway, all right, let's pause there. We'll pick up on the rest of the story. Actually, let's finish 17, because I'm never going to remember where we stopped at this point, so I need like a big number in my Bible to remember, okay?
Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. Now Absalom had set Amasa over the army instead of Joab. Amasa was the son of a man named Ithra.
All right, stop there. So Amasa is the new Joab in town, okay? We don't necessarily need to know his whole lineage. But Joab got put on the bench. Okay, he's David's nephew. Amasa is David's mesh nephew. Okay, so there's still relation in there. He's Absalom's cousin. So Absalom is getting a guy that he knows and trusts and he grew up with. You're going to be the new commander of my armies. Okay, so just remember that guy's name. Verse 27, keep rolling there.
When David came to Mahanaim, Shobi, the son of Nahash from Rabbah of the Ammonites, and Machir, son of Amiel from Lodabar, and Barzillai the Gileadite from Rogelim, brought beds, basins, and earthen vessels, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans, and lentils.
And a partridge and a pear tree. They bring them all this stuff. Okay, verse 27, Makur, the son of Amiel from
Lodabar.
Who have we met from Lodabar?
Mephibosheth.
How has David's grace to Mephibosheth affected the people that live in Lodabar? They bring David, like, here's a bed to sleep in, here's a buffet, here's someone to rub your feet. What do you need? Shelter, anything, right? So it's cool that it seems like in this barren place, literally it means barren place, wasteland, desert, that these people now take care of him. The people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness, and David is taken care of because of the grace that he gave Mephibosheth years ago, is now being shown to David as a result of that, okay? So we'll pick up on 18 and the rest of the story. David's about to go head-to-head with his son, Absalom, so we'll pick on that in 2 weeks, okay, when we get back from break. So you guys have a great spring break, okay? Enjoy, be safe, and we'll see you guys 2 weeks from yesterday.